Welcome back, everyone, to the Cyber People podcast. This is season 2, episode 5. It has been a very long time between drinks. It's nothing to do with a lack of motivation or anything like that. It's just been super crazy chasing lots of rabbits and a very hectic end to last year. So good to be back. And we're very honored, delighted, and privileged to have Mr. Jason Ford joining us today. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much.
How does it feel to be on the Cyber People podcast?
Incredible, Will. What can I say?
That's awesome. Well, listen, rather than me telling everyone all about you, why don't you tell us who you are, what you do, and how you ended up doing it?
Yeah, sure. Well, that's a bit of an open question, but I guess, so basically I work as the head of red teaming at TPG Telecom. And prior to that, I was the ANZ practice lead for all things offensive security. And before that, I was run-of-the-mill pen tester, and I often feel in this role, I get a lot of advice, requests for advice. A lot of people want to know what's like to be a pen tester, how to get in, how to progress your career. So that's what I hope to talk about today, I guess.
Awesome. Now, you were a pen tester, and then you moved more towards the leadership side of things.
Correct, yeah.
Are you still hands-on?
Occasionally. I always try to manage to still be a little bit hands-on, but the more responsibility you take on, the less and less hands-on time you get, sadly. I still am very close to it. I still have a great team who keep me in the loop of what they're actually doing, but a large part of my job now is more stakeholder management.
Okay. All right. Is it important to stay hands-on in terms of commanding the respect of your team?
Yes and no. I often feel I've always been a person who believes you need to walk the walk to be able to talk the talk. So I still believe it is important to be, to an extent, hands-on. And as such, I still do a bit of study on the side, whether it's just hacking around with my own little Arduino projects or doing courses or jumping on Hack the Box. There is always something that I do, which I still remain hands-on. In terms of day-to-day operations, a lot less. But I feel knowing the technology, knowing the process, knowing what goes on, I feel like is important if you were to lead a team. But largely speaking, I think a large part of leadership is owning what you don't know and trusting your team to deliver.
Okay. All right. Now, you mentioned projects. What was the word you said before projects? I didn't catch it. Arduino?
Arduinos, yeah.
What is an Arduino project?
Arduinos are just basically like a programmable circuit board. So for me, having very little background in electrical engineering, it was, you know, a fun dive into that area, learning about how physical devices work. Anything from like this very microphone to, I don't know, a keyboard or anything digital, really. So I did this as a way to kind of start bridging the gap more from the IT perspective into the OT or operational technology perspective. Still a long way to go until I get more to the OT side, but it's an introduction into more the electrical engineering, which will lead down that path. So something to, I guess, kickstart that learning journey.
How would you, in layman terms, explain the difference between IT and OT?
Very simply, IT is about information and computers, blinky boxes, things doing stuff. OT is the physical world. So when we actually have machinery or, chemical enrichment or anything like that, anything that is any industrial control system that is controlled through a computer system would be OT. So typically speaking now, as OT and IT, the borders are getting closer together, we are seeing that overlap. And from a security point of view, this is something that is starting to get a bit more momentum now, but largely still neglected. So I think it's definitely something that I need to look into more to understand a bit more about what's going on in the OT space and the threats associated with it, how, you know, malicious actors could hack into, go in through a phishing email and move laterally into an OT network and literally start blowing things up.
Okay. So at the moment in your current role, what would you say the split is between OT and IT?
mostly, I would say 95% IT. Telecommunications is still very IT heavy. The 5% more so on your RANs, your radios, things like that, which I guess can kind of fall within the realm of OT, but not specifically. It's kind of its own little area, I suspect.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's just travel back in time to the beginning of your career as a pen tester.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I was working at a small consulting company associated with you guys. Is now associated with you guys. So it just came from a run-of-the-mill question to my line of manager at the time, saying, "Hey, I think cybersecurity is going to take off in the next few years. I think we should start a practice." I wasn't the first person to raise this, and the person Graham was, and I think Chris as well, were both very receptive to that idea, and they actually paved the way for it to happen internally. So something I'm still very grateful for, because this was how I transitioned from doing more performance and technical architecture into more security. Which, you know, I was right. This was, I think, 2017 when I raised this. This is just off the back of the WannaCry attack in 2017, which, if you remember, was pretty devastating to a lot of hospitals in the UK, and a lot of computers exposed to the internet. So, that's what really kind of kickstarted it, and we built the practice from there. We hired a great manager who I worked with very closely for the next 5 or 6 years. And yeah.
Okay. So you were doing performance testing. You spotted a gap in the market. So it sounded like you already sort of had your eye in that direction anyway. It sounded like you're already developing a bit of an interest in that.
Correct.
In that field.
Yeah. This was before cybersecurity was a cool, sexy thing. So at my job before that consulting, at another consulting company, nobody wanted to work in the security team, because they would be working up late all night. They would leave the office about midnight every night. They'd have a lot of work to do. Nobody wanted to do that work. And that included me at the time as well. I didn't want to work those hours. But I did entertain it at the time, because I started to get bored with doing tech architecture and performance testing. So I didn't immediately take it up on that, but a few years later, I could see that it was a growing trend. It's like, all right, I think I need to take the plunge and do this.
Okay. So are you a night owl?
I'm a bit of I'd say I'm a bit of a morning bird. What is it? Early bird?
A lark.
Yeah. But then I sleep throughout the midday, and then back up at night from about 7 till midnight is probably my peak operation. Throughout the middle of the day, I'm just gone.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Distraction free.
Yeah.
Okay. So does that mean, I mean, how do you manage that when you've got team members who rely on you? Like, just switch into autopilot zombie mode?
No. I operate just fine throughout the standard working hours. But if I wanted to achieve that state of flow where I could be behind a terminal for hours on end, like when I did my OSCP, it would be morning, break throughout the day, then till late at night.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. He's not falling asleep in the middle of the day, TPG, just in case you're listening. He's fully productive. Don't worry about it. Okay. So was it like a commercial motivation? Did you see it as like a sort of business opportunity, or was it more technical interest?
A bit of both. I largely thought it was a good way to grow my career, but also I thought this is just going to get bigger. So I wanted to progress my career. I didn't want to keep doing the same thing over and over again. I think by this point I had about 4 or 5 years as a performance tester. So I was looking for something new to do, something interesting, something that had a bit more depth, because performance testing, I found really, really interesting, especially when doing all the statistical analysis, it just became very process oriented and the same thing over again. And I needed a bit more spark, a deeper bucket, so to speak.
Right. Okay. So how does one transition, that's a funny way of putting it, how does one transition from performance testing and the other areas of testing that you were in into pen testing? Like, what makes you a good pen? What does a pen tester actually do? Can you kind of talk me through a day in the life?
Yeah, so I think pen testing is probably one of the things that is really misunderstood. I think a lot of people are attracted to the whole idea of being the elusive hacker, wearing a black hoodie behind a keyboard with blinky boxes behind them till the wee hours of the morning. The reality is, being a pen tester it's still a job. It's still a 9-to-5. You still have to communicate with your clients or with your managers, set expectations, deliver the work, write reports. And largely speaking, it's still a technical job, but largely speaking, it's still another job. And I often think a lot of people don't really fully consider what being a pen tester is like. They might do a few things on like Hack the Box or Pen Tester Labs and think that their day job is going to be like that all day, every day, solving solvable challenges. But the reality is, they're not like those labs. The reality is, sometimes you can't break it. And sometimes it takes a long time to get anywhere. Sometimes you'll be banging your head against a brick wall all day and then at the end of the project deliver literally nothing. So I think what makes a good pen tester is the tenacity to keep going, but also being very, very good with rejection, because you might try 1,000 things on, let's say, on a web application, try 1,000 things and none of them work. And you've got to be okay with that. So long as you are sure that you've done everything you can and you've leveraged every attack that you think is possible across the attack surface, then you've got to be okay with that, even if your report just shows a bunch of informational findings.
Okay. But I guess from a client perspective, that's good news, right? The fact that you weren't able to crack in or break it or, you know.
Yes and no.
No?
Yes and no. So working over the hundreds of clients I have in this space over the past however many years, you come across your clients who want the big results. Who have very little confidence in their own system and expect you to break it. And when you show otherwise, then they don't believe you. Or, you know, similarly, if it's across a network range, like, yeah, we've got holes everywhere and they got to find so much. And then when you find particularly little, then it can feel like you're on the back foot a little bit, trying to justify why this took you so long, justify the expense and everything like that. Because a lot of the time, you, especially as a pen tester, think that you need to deliver results. And that's a good thing, because that's going to keep you going. That's going to keep you motivated. That's going to keep you probably working longer than what you are actually contracted to work on it. But on the other hand, pen testing, especially pen testing, is largely seen as a tick box exercise by a lot of project managers. And this is something that I'm trying to change working internal now. So traditionally, most pen testing is outsourced to, you know, a consulting company. And they do the test, they flick back a report. Yep, tick the box, we've done pen testing, we can have that assurance. And from a assurance and compliance perspective, that's all they need. From a perspective of actually making the system better, that's generally not helpful. And this is a trend that I'm seeing and that I'm actively contributing to by bringing pen testing internally. You're not under the same time pressure as consulting. You're not billing, you know, $1,500 to $2,500 a day for your services. Your internal staff, the whole metrics, the whole calculation is different. So you have the time, you're afforded the time to go deeper, to pull the thing apart, not just follow this checklist and work with the application team or the network team, whatever the scope is, to really pull apart. So if you're testing an application, you might be able to get the code or the customization code on top, depending on what the platform is, and actually pull that apart as from a source code level, as well as doing a dynamic testing perspective. So you're able, I feel like having that internal perspective delivers far better value. It's not just this tick box exercise that pen testing has largely become. It's actually, let's make our product better.
Okay. So do most companies, in your experience, build their own pen testing capability internally and also engage consultancies to kind of, you know, mark their homework or get a second opinion in a way?
I think it's a very new trend towards the end of 2023. A lot of companies are building internal teams. I'm not sure if I should name names, but I know Qantas are doing it. I know Macquarie Bank and BFS, which is a bank, and Macquarie COG, which is a core operations group, do it. I know Wesfarmers are starting it. I know a whole bunch of Origin Energy. There's probably a few more that I can't remember off the top of my head, but a lot of these places are still starting to build internal teams because I think they're starting to realize how much they're spending on consultants every year and realizing that they're not getting bang for the buck. So, and then when it comes to, okay, do we get consulting? There's a few things that they might still need consulting for, whether it's compliance work. So PCI testing may be done externally. The condition is that it's functionally independent, so it's a gray area. There can be also surge demand. So if, for example, my team has 50 pen tests that they need to deliver by the end of April, okay, I'm going to need to use consultants. But largely speaking, I think, it's largely just for compliance, all that surge demand.
Okay. All right. So your motivation to leave consulting and go on to enterprise was to make penetration testing or offensive security in general a much more integral part of the whole process.
Yeah.
And the scope of the work that you're engaged on is far deeper and far broader.
Exactly.
Okay.
So if you look at the service offerings that these consulting companies are giving you, they'll give you a pen test, or they'll give you a network pen test, or a web application pen test, or a mobile application pen test, or source code review or config review or something like that, right? They're very individually packaged services. They're not having and this isn't to do anything about the consultants themselves or the consulting companies. It's just the nature of going external. You don't have that ingrained connection with the team responsible for delivering this project. So internal, you know, you can go talk to somebody at their desk, or you can have a Teams call or ping them on Teams or whatever, have whatever form of communication and have that bi-directional channel. Be able just to go beyond the scope, not have such a rigid scope of, yep, we're going to test this URL, nothing more, nothing less. We have the luxury internal of having a broader look, spending more time, going deeper, being more thorough, and the results are better. I have, so far already, I have done a test where I got an external consultancy to do it, and I got the same test done by my internal team, and the results we found were just so much greater, so much deeper, so much wider, because they had the time, they weren't so constrained.
Okay.
Yeah.
How often do you get contrary results? Do you ever come up with something completely different to what the external consultancy delivered?
I wouldn't say completely different, no, but it's just, I think having the internal team just gives you far, far more depth and width in the scope.
Okay. So you were talking about tenacity, you know, I was reminded a little bit of Thomas Edison and his light bulb, you know, thousands of tests and it kept going wrong.
Yep, yep.
But he just kept on doing it until finally he cracked it. So tenacity is very important. You mentioned rejection as well. There are some similarities with recruitment there, I couldn't help noticing.
Yep.
So what about creativity? Like, as a penetration tester, pen tester, are you can you come at it any way you want? Can you be super creative in the way that you go about doing it, or are you typically using a specific set of tools a specific way?
Yeah, that's a good question. A lot of the time it is very prescriptive nowadays. I think we have our pen test frameworks. Pretty much every company will throw out the term OWASP top 10, and you have to largely stick to that standard and that methodology using the same tools. I feel like pen testing is becoming more commoditized to the point where it's just, we don't need specialists anymore. We can just run these tools, run against this methodology and find out, because I feel like a lot of the heavy lifting has been done already through developing these tools. And especially when it is just on this endless churn of, you know, pen testers working 5 days here, 3 days there, 2 days there, 7 days here, just on project after project after project. I often think they don't have the time and luxury to bring that creativity in. So I feel like pen testers can be creative. They can find better ways of doing things. They can go deeper on a new technology or web framework or whatever it is to try and find those novel exploits. But largely speaking, it's so commoditized to the point where, you know, if especially if they're in a consulting company, they need to be billable for 80-90% of the year. So they're not going to have that luxury. They're not going to have that time to have that creativity.
Okay. All right. So if you're in one of the big consulting firms in the pen testing team, are you typically doing multiple engagements simultaneously?
I can only speak for the consultancy I was in and all consultancies I was in. And the direct answer to that is no. I think it's very unethical if you're double dipping, double billing for the same day. But sometimes, you know, you can be working on a project and the project needs to pause, in which case you pick up another one and run with that until it resumes. And you might have to juggle between the two, but you're never splitting, you're never dividing your time, you're never splitting your effort. You're still giving that full effort to the client that they paid for, as they should. But yeah, sometimes it's a bit of juggling.
Okay. Because I can imagine, I mean, I don't know if this is a correct perception, but I would imagine that if you are an aspiring pen tester, probably one of the best things you could do would be to join a consulting firm where you're going to be working across multiple clients throughout the year. And I would imagine that, you know, what work you might be sort of, there might be a cross-pollination of ideas. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, on this particular project, strategy A worked really well. Let me see if I can bring that across and produce similar results for this client. So am I correct in thinking that one's learning curve is a lot steeper?
I think being in a consultancy at the beginning and having that rapid fire of projects is very, very good, because you're going to be exposed to a lot of technology, a lot of projects, a lot of project teams as well very quickly, and you're going to learn a lot very fast. But I think you will hit that point where, okay, this is just blending into the same thing week in, week out.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And that's when you, one of the catalysts for you to move on.
Yeah. That was one of the things that got me into management. I didn't go seeking to go into management or leadership. It was largely, when I joined Accenture, I think it was the first week. My first week at Accenture, the manager who hired me resigned, and the managing director came to me and said, "Oh, hey, such and such resigned. Do you want to lead the team?" I'm like, "Mate, I've been here less than a week."
Yeah.
But he's like, "Well, because I had worked at Accenture previously, I knew how the place worked. I knew how statements of work are written. I know how all the internal billings and project management tools and everything, and how to run a team, because effectively I did that previously, or run projects." I was, yeah, pretty much voluntold to take that position. I thought, but it was great. And I didn't look back, because I figured I like interacting with people. I am a big picture person. I think pen testers are very much caught in the finer details, as they need to be. I like to work across a bigger strategy, and I felt like I didn't know that I wanted this, but now that I've got it, I don't want to go back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they say that reluctant leaders are the best leaders, and you have to be wary of the ones who really, really, really want it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that could have been one of the fastest promotions
possibly
in history. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Interesting. So you were talking about frameworks and OWASP, of course, that is a ubiquitous word in this business. If you were giving some advice to aspiring pen testers out there, maybe people who haven't yet started their career in pen testing, but they're keen to get started, or they're early on in their career and they want to accelerate, what advice would you give?
Yeah.
Certifications.
Yeah, yeah.
Those sorts of things.
So, largely speaking, pen testing is insanely competitive. Everybody wants to be that elusive hacker, right?
Yeah.
You need to be distinguished. You need to be somebody, you need to rise above everybody else who wants to be a pen tester. And there's lots of different ways of doing that. Some people like to go do certificates and, you know, the infamous OSCP. That is a very, how do I say?
Ordeal.
It's a big ordeal, yeah. But it is almost almost a guarantee that you will get a pen test job. Maybe not being paid the most, but it's a junior. You'll get in as a junior. You'll have that opportunity, and you can go from there. I have also worked with pen testers who have no certifications and are just absolutely incredible. And that it is that distinct talent. Once again, they have proven themselves. They don't just do things like Hack the Box or Pentester Lab or any of those free services. They're pulling things apart themselves or building things. I knew a guy who was building his own operating system, for example. Why, I don't know, but it was his project. And he learned so much about how to code in C first and foremost, but how the software interacts on the hardware layer and everything like that, which he could then bring into, you know, really advanced exploit development and things like that on red teams. So I think it's largely speaking, if you want to be a pen tester, you need to be very tenacious. You need to live and breathe it. You need to want absolutely nothing else but this, and being willing to make the sacrifice. So when I did my OSCP, it was, I think, about 45 hours of study per week for 3 months. You can now do the OSCP over a year, but when I did it, it was 2 months, plus I got another month extension. So about 2.5 months of 40 plus hours of study per week.
On top of your full-time job.
So it was all weekend, or you know, I think 10 hours on weekends, and I think I tried to go for 3 or 4 hours per weeknight. So it was insane. It was a grind.
Wow. Yeah. So it has to become an obsession.
Absolutely.
It's not a 9-to-5 thing. This is a proper vocation.
Correct.
This is who you are.
Yes. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I guess that's why the field has that identity, that strong identity, because, you know, people fundamentally really identify with, they work hard to achieve that. So yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's impressive. So you didn't really see your family very much during
barely.
Okay.
Or friends, or did anything other than just, I made sure that I got a half-hour walk every day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sanity walk.
My sanity walk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you were saying about this guy who was pulling things apart and doing all this stuff in his spare time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the clients that we work with will ask during interviews what people's personal projects are. You know, what are they doing at home outside of office hours? And
yep.
A lot of them will say, look, unless they give me some goods in those areas, I'm really not interested. Because
yep.
they want that commitment, that obsession, that passion.
Absolutely. You know? And it's what I look for when I hire as well. So when I hired my team, I wanted to know what people were doing in their spare time, what projects. And I didn't care if they were doing, again, these free training platforms or building something of their own. I much more gravitated towards the people who were independent learners rather than the people who were told how to learn. I think there's a balance for sure. You don't know what you don't know, so you go do a course or certificate or something to learn that. But largely speaking, the people who are creating, the people who are finding better ways to do things or to reverse engineer things, I think those are the people that I want on my team.
Okay. How technical do you need to be? Like, if you want to be a very successful pen tester, do you need to be a developer, a coder?
I think there is a large degree of coding in a area of pen testing / red team or offensive security. If you're doing source code reverse engineering or you're working on exploit development, then yeah, largely speaking, you need to be a solid programmer. If you are more keen on the actual evasion and exploitation path, not so much, but you really need to know, not so much as a developer, but still highly technical. You need to know how detections are triggered, what SOC teams are looking for, and how you can, you know, effectively live off the land. It's not like in a lot of these lads where you throw on some malware tool and that will give you a C2 connection and you can run all your tools and go wild. It's a lot lower, it's a lot slower, it's a lot more tactical.
What about, am I correct in thinking that before you got into offensive security, you hadn't actually worked in security at all? Had you ever done anything on the defensive side?
I never worked in the defensive side, no. I think my interest insecurity testing came from performance testing. So performance testing is very, very scripting heavy. You're writing a lot of scripts in Python or in C. And a lot of the time when testing web, doing performance testing on web applications, you are working with those HTTP payloads. And it's like, well, what happens if I changed this data input to this, which isn't available on the user interface, but if I changed it, would I be able to, you know, for example, perform a request that only an administrator would be able to do? And it was that kind of curiosity that started me thinking, oh, maybe I can do this, focus more on this rather than looking at the performance side, but looking at the security side.
Right.
So that's kind of how I got into pen testing. I don't think at the time pen testing was such a thing as pen testing. It was more security testing. And it was still like under the umbrella of non-functional testing. So it didn't have that whole allure about it. It was just more so a curiosity that led me there.
Okay. Because when I think about the applications that you're testing, there's so many different applications. They're written in so many different languages. Mm-hmm. You were talking about OT earlier, embedded systems. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of those are written in like C++ and so forth. Mm-hmm. So does one as a pen tester have to be a multilingual coder? Like, are you constantly learning new languages?
I think so, to an extent. If you want to be just a run-of-the-mill pen tester testing web applications 9 to 5, then probably not. But that being said, you know, if you want to specialize in testing web applications, then you can get really freaking good at it. You can learn a lot more about how web applications are built. I think the best way to learn to break something is learn how to build it first. So that gives you this unique insight on how to pull it apart, how to reverse engineer it. So yeah, in answer to your question, I think being somewhat multi-programming lingual is a requirement. I guess it really depends on what avenue you kind of want to go down. But I think largely speaking, you need to be highly technical, regardless if it's coding or not.
Okay, yeah. Got it. And, you know, you were telling that somewhat humorous story of joining Accenture as a pen tester, and then within your first week, you were made a manager because your boss left a week after you joined. I hope you didn't take that personally, by the
no,
way.
No, no.
Sure has nothing to do with you. But very different skill sets, being a pen tester and then managing a pen testing practice.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you build and run a successful pen testing practice?
Right. I don't know how I can sum that up in just one answer. I think there's a lot of different elements to look at it. There's a culture aspect. I felt like pen testers need to feel like they're working in that collaborative, fostering environment. Otherwise, they're going to go somewhere else. And I had a lot of resignations when I took over. And that was largely, I think, because it was an acquisition that I was thrown into and started managing. But I also think, it was just largely about the culture fit from being a niche, independent pen testing firm into a big corporate mega company of nearly 1 million people called Accenture. So I think largely speaking, people didn't like being microscoped. They didn't like having chargeability targets and stuff like that. So a lot of them left. That taught me that pen testers themselves need to have that environment where they can feel like they can keep pushing the envelope, where they are supported. They don't have to be billable every second of the day. And largely speaking, that was one of my biggest challenges when I worked at Accenture, was to maintain that collaborative, fostering, fun environment while still managing the targets set by the business.
No one likes KPIs, right?
Nobody
KPIs.
Likes KPIs. But across from the people side, you have, you know, the more business side, the finance side. How can we justify keeping a team of X amount of pen testers when we might not be bringing in this much money, or when the peaks and troughs of pen testing projects, which is consistent across everywhere I've worked in consulting, you know, the peaks are high and you're struggling to schedule everything in, and the troughs are so low, everybody's sitting around and you're being asked, you have that pressure, why are your staff sitting around? You're going to have to let somebody go if things don't improve. So it's a lot of managing expectations, a lot of stakeholder management. being that front man for your team, or woman for your team, so they don't see these pressures that come externally. You be their shield in a way.
So it almost sounds like a law firm, you know. You have to be constantly billing the client. So did they have to, on an individual level, did they have commercial responsibility, or was that all on you?
That's a bit of both.
Okay.
The way I structured things, and not singling out Accenture, I know every consulting company is like this, and it makes sense. Companies need to make money. Why would we pay salaries for people who aren't making us money, right? That's fair enough. The way I did it at Accenture was I just had my team forward any emails about chargeability or anything from HR or anything to me, and I would handle it. I would manage the business. I would manage them, so they didn't have to manage themselves. So they could focus on doing what they wanted to do. They didn't have to worry about their targets. They didn't have to worry about, well, of course, they still had to do mandatory training, but largely speaking, I kept them as shielded from the rest of the business as possible.
Okay. I was interested in what you were saying about peaks and troughs, you know, like any other economic cycle.
Yeah.
There's no difference for offensive security. Am I correct in thinking that the peaks are right before regulatory deadlines and things like that? Like, what's driving that cycle?
A lot of the peaks tend to happen towards the end of the financial year in Australia. So, you know, your April, June, July are generally flat out as projects are trying to finalize things before the end of the year and use budget before it's gone. And on the opposite side, around the end of the year to start of January is generally very slow because a lot of companies are under change embargoes. They don't want any high priority incidents over the holiday period. So a lot of them go on to change freeze or embargoes. So there's not that disruption to the business. But as a result, the consulting companies that send people out to do the pen testing or performance testing or whatever it is tend to have to bear the brunt of that for a little while.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Q4 is the busy season?
Q4, financial year, Q4, yeah. Okay. Tends to be busy, and end of quarter two tends to be quite slow.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Great time to book your time off, pen testers. So you mentioned that soon after you took over the reins from your departed boss, a lot of people left.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not uncommon in changing of the guard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some leave to follow their previous manager.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You had to build it back up from scratch.
Yep.
How did you go about doing that?
So I think this is one of the things where having a strong network is very, very important. And as a techie earlier on in my career, I was just like, I just want to be behind a computer. I don't want to have to network. I don't want to have to talk to people. in my junior years, I was a bit arrogant that way. As I progressed through my career, I noticed your network is everything. And I've never applied for a job. I've always been headhunted. Even from the end of uni, I was headhunted into Accenture. So I've never applied for a job. And largely speaking, that's because of my network. I've been able to move around. I've been going from great job to great job. Largely because of my network. So in answer to your question, building that team back up largely came from, okay, who do I know? Who do I know in this industry? I go to, not as much as I should nowadays, but I go to SecTalks, which is industry-wide networking events in for security. I speak at CyberCon every year generally. And I go to B-Sides and all of these conferences and anything where I can continue to maintain my network. So I had a whole bunch of people who either I knew directly or indirectly, and a few people I didn't know at all, but they stacked up both technically in the tech interview as well as, or the tech assessment, as well as interpersonally. And, you know, I feel culture fit is extremely important and having a good mindset. So it was largely just hiring people back up and expecting a few more that I had to fall off because I knew they were unhappy, and that's okay. I was okay with them moving on to bigger and brighter things or where they wanted to work. So a large part of that was maintaining that relationship, not getting sour with the people who I knew were on their way out, as long as I knew they could still deliver their work. And yeah.
Well, that's the attraction part. That's the getting them through the door.
Mm-hmm.
What about the retention part? Once they're through the door, how do you get them to stay there?
Retention is difficult because maybe not so much nowadays, but between 2020 to about 2022, maybe a little bit of 2023, salaries were going through the roof. And I jumped a couple of times throughout that period as well to chase the bigger dollars. So retention is difficult, but having a strong culture is important. So maintaining, you know, that collaborative environment, making sure pen testers rock up to work every day and they're talking to other pen testers. I know a lot of people hate it, but I think collaboration days in the office are extremely important because you work on things together, you shoulder surf, you come up with ideas together, and you know, it's really, really, really productive. Also, if you are providing some sort of training or, you know, certification path and career progression, then I think that's extremely important. Pen testers always like to grow. They always want to do the next certificate, or they always want to do some hack the box or something in their free time. So providing that for them to do is super important, because most pen testers don't go do their OSCP and then call it a day. They're always looking forward.
Okay. So they're very hungry, thirsty, insatiable.
Absolutely.
Specimens.
Mm-hmm.
So this is probably a good segue into red teaming, because
mm-hmm.
I would imagine a great way to retain excellent pen testers is to develop them into the red team.
Yes.
What is red teaming? How does it differ to penetration testing?
Yeah, so we're all speaking the same language. Red teaming typically is seen as adversary simulation or emulation, and I won't split hairs here between the difference, but this is doing a full-scale attack on a business rather than pen testing, which is just looking at a particular application or network or a very limited scope to find all vulnerabilities. Red teaming is more so, let's attack the entire business to gain some objective. And that objective is always something to do with business impact. Can we take core systems offline? Can we steal personally identifiable information and hold that to ransom? Can we do something that is going to impact the business, to cause a high priority incident, to make them face the media, typically speaking? So typically speaking, there is a high barrier between being a pen tester and to being a red teamer. And this is one thing that I talked about at CyberCon last year. And I think this barrier is actually really damaging, because the way I see it is everybody has unique skills. As you progress in your career, you naturally become more expensive, especially in consulting. So it's in everybody's best interest to get people doing red teaming sooner. That doesn't mean you're going to be behind a terminal and, you know, after you've breached and got your initial access, that doesn't mean a junior is going to be running every single command and alerting the SOC. It's more about how we divvy up the tasks. So a lot of the time, you know, phishing and social engineering is a large component of it. Well, a junior can write a good phishing email and understand motivations and what would be likely targets and find the targets and create fake websites for the organization you're pretending to be and helping in that aspect. Similarly, they can look through the external perimeter. They can try and find exploit paths or start developing their own exploits. And they can assist internally as well, even though that might not be their strength. So largely speaking, this barriers, I think, is very damaging and very divisive between the pen testers and the red teamers, and the ones who are the elite team and the run-of-the-mill team. So if somebody wants to progress, largely speaking, you should probably find a company which has a bit more open mind to it. But in addition, you need to start making sure you are building those skills as well. So not just thinking, okay, I'm a pen tester, I should be able to do red teaming. You got to take it upon yourself to build those skills, maybe do some certifications or training in that particular area so you know what you're doing, but also, you know, trying to find a supportive team which aren't going to gatekeep it.
Okay. So you're trying to lower the barriers to entry.
Correct.
In your current role?
Yep. So in my team, I have people who have never done red teaming before, and I'm throwing them straight in the deep end. But I also have people who are highly experienced in it and can support them. And best of all, they are open-minded to support them.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. One of my many weaknesses is time management. And I feel like red teaming is probably deserving of its own podcast entirely.
Quite possibly.
So we might have to make this a two-parter. What do you think, Jason?
Sounds good.
In the interim, can you tell everyone how to get in touch with you? Tell them about your YouTube channel.
Yeah.
I'm sure people are going to want to reach out for some advice, some inspo.
Certainly.
How do they find you?
So you can find me on LinkedIn, Jason Ford. You can also find me on YouTube, JasonFord/JasonSec. So on YouTube, I just post a range of things, but largely speaking, technical tutorials, how to, you know, hack Wi-Fi, or, you know, how to, a guide to the OSCP, for example, and things like that. So you can find me there, and yeah, reach out. Happy to answer your questions. If I get a lot of the same questions, I might make a video of it, so as to not have to answer the same questions a lot. But yeah,
automation. Yeah, automation. That's something I would like to talk about next time as well, is the use of automation and AI, the degree to which AI is leveraged these days, and in pen testing and red teaming. And then we can also maybe talk about purple teaming as well.
Sounds good.
But listen, thank you so much for coming on.
No worries, it's been a pleasure.
I really enjoyed it, and I look forward to the next one.
Sounds good, likewise.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
Bye.